It's finally available. I've been working on a manuscript for the past 4 years, and it is finally a book I can hold in my hands. It's titled, Is God Disappointed in Me? Removing Shame from a Gospel of Grace. This book has gotten so much attention that it is already a number one Amazon bestseller. I'm beyond amazed. In just a few words, I wrote, Is God Disappointed in Me? For Latter-day Saints who often feel overwhelmed by the gospel and who are constantly worrying if they are doing enough. It's for the Latter-day Saint who have stepped away from the church. It's for the individuals who appear to be living right, but still can't find peace and happiness. And frankly, it's for everyone who enjoys listening to the Leading Saints podcast. You will love and cherish this book. Now, warning, you might want to consider purchasing multiple copies to share. One bishop who got an advance copy read it in one weekend and then literally purchased 100 additional copies. You can order it on Amazon, the link is in the show notes, or starting in March, you can find it in your local Costco in Idaho, Utah, and Arizona. It's called Is God Disappointed in Me? And you can order it now. If you wanted further insight into a Come Follow Me lesson, you'd probably search in YouTube or get the We Believe app. Tough church history questions? You'd reach out to the B.H. Roberts Foundation. But what if you wanted to learn to be a better leader? Well, I'm glad you asked. You'd come to Leading Saints. That's why we exist, to help Latter-day Saints be better prepared to lead by being familiar with others' leadership experiences, understand the latest leadership research, and finding a community to share ideas. That's why I'm glad you found the Leading Saints podcast. We hope you will dive into the archives and visit leadingsaints.org to find out what are the top, most listened to episodes on the podcast. Welcome. You're going to love it. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Leading Saints podcast. You know, I've touched on this topic before, this topic of betrayal trauma, but I wanted to get an updated, more current episode where I talk with an expert, a therapist, and that person being Ashley Levitt, who is a remarkable therapist who specializes in this concept of betrayal trauma. Now, some of you are probably hearing this, like, what is betrayal trauma? Why should I care? But when you need to know about betrayal trauma, you really need to know about betrayal trauma because it can be so traumatizing for those involved. So a quick example, you have a great family in your ward. Husband and wife seem to be getting along great. They're happy. They show up to church. Their kids seem relatively well-behaved and they're down a path that's going well. Well, there's some betrayal happening behind the scenes. Maybe it's a struggle with pornography. Maybe it's infidelity. There's a list of reasons and this comes to the surface and that causes trauma for the spouse in the relationship or the children. It's as if somebody set off a bomb in their home and they don't know how to grapple with it. Here we have this trusted husband, father, individual in the community. And now that he's betrayed us, and how do we grapple with that? And so many people make rash decisions, and so many bishops or church leaders put on their shoulders sort of this responsibility of fixing the situation and helping them through it. When in reality, there's so much to consider, so many dynamics going on. So Ashley really does a marvelous job with her expertise as a therapist in guiding us through this journey of understanding what betrayal trauma is. How does it show up? Because oftentimes it's behind the scenes. You don't even know it's there, but it's causing so much damage. And so this will be an episode you may want to listen to a few times as you pick up on what betrayal trauma is, how to identify it, and how to help people through it. So here's my interview with Ashley Levitt. Today, I'm welcoming in Ashley Levitt to the Leading Saints podcast. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. Now, I got to give a shout out to our mutual friend, Becky Beck, who connected us. We grew up in the same ward, and she sent me a message and said, you've got to talk with Ashley. So here
she's amazing and does incredible work, and I'm so honored.
The reason I've been looking for somebody, and we'll probably do multiple episodes around this topic because it is so important. And it's like this hidden, relationship virus that never gets addressed and often becomes a bigger problem because we don't. And that is the concept of betrayal trauma. So assume that we know nothing about betrayal trauma. And maybe let me like that, because especially from a bishop standpoint or who's like working with maybe couples behind the scene who are experiencing betrayal trauma, they're sort of trying to untangle this all and understand it. But even like families who will be faced with betrayal trauma, and they don't know what to do with it. It just feels like a bomb went off in their house. Yeah. And so assuming we know nothing, where do we start with betrayal trauma?
Okay.
What is it? Where do we begin?
In this realm, in this application, we're going to be talking about betrayal trauma specifically in regards to how one partner in a marriage is feeling emotional distress due to the sexual acting out behaviors of their spouse.
Right.
And those behaviors might be like physical infidelity. They've cheated with someone. They might be virtual infidelity. Maybe it's pornography addiction that's going on, emotional infidelity. All of those types of behaviors come along. And with those behaviors, there's this subset of behaviors that are usually like the gaslighting and the manipulation, kind of those buzzwords that we're seeing. Hmm. Those come along with these kind of sexual acting out behaviors. And those ones are the ones that cause damage. And those behaviors result in the partner that's been betrayed feeling just this complete confusion about what their life is and where it's going and who they can trust and what's going on. And that experience is what we call betrayal trauma.
Right.
And it can come with all sorts of side effects, I guess you could say, all sorts of like emotional, physical. We see people, their physical health drains when they're going through betrayal trauma, their mental health, their emotional health. It's like PTSD is happening in that person, even though the trauma that they're experiencing is less traumatic than, say, like a bomb exploded while I was in war, but it's affecting them just as much as that may happen.
Yeah, because trauma, I mean, that's sort of the big umbrella concept that we're talking about. We're talking something specific because a soldier who goes to war obviously enters a very traumatic situation, almost dies or gets injured and can't sleep at night. That PTSD, like that is very understandable. But imagine this. Instead of being sent off to war, like the war sneaks into your house and suddenly the bomb goes off in your house. And then with the most trusted people, right? The friendliest to fire betrays. And now that trauma has a little bit different flavor. Not that it's worse or easier or whatever. It's just different.
Yeah. Right? And it's a different in a way that we don't often talk about. I think society has shifted to where we can say PTSD with a veteran who's come and we kind of all go, oh, I understand what's happening. But we don't think about that same kind of trauma and those same types of results of that trauma happening from just like a relationship disagreement.
Right.
Because we kind of minimize that relationship disagreement to it's not a big thing. But when betrayal trauma is happening in your relationship, a bomb has just gone off in your relationship. And even figuring out which way is up is really hard.
Yeah. And we'll sort of go back to these general examples. I think what one that a lot of, you know, bishops or church leaders see or loved ones around certain people is, you know, there's infidelity, even with not necessarily physical infidelity where there's an affair, but even with, you know, an individual, a wife catches their husband viewing pornography and then realizes this has been going on like even before their marriage, right? And they've been hiding it. And I thought I trusted you. And now I like, if this, then what else, right? Yeah. And that's sort of a typical scenario. I hate to generalize things, but that's a general scenario.
Right. Yeah, yeah, that's a very common scenario. And those thoughts that you just attributed, I thought I trusted you, and if this, then what else, are all very common thoughts to be having during this.
Now, what typically happens in the church setting is that, okay, this is not okay. You need to go see your bishop, right?
Or
we need to get this fixed. I'm calling the bishop over. I remember being that bishop that gets the phone call and walks into that you know, rampage after the bomb has just exploded, right? Or they come into the office and it's like, all right, you need to take care of this, right?
Yeah.
And as a bishop, sometimes I need to take swift action. I need to do something, right?
Yeah.
When in reality, so much is going on, right? And the best sometimes is just got to slow it down. But I don't, you know, you don't know how to slow it down, right?
Yeah.
So where's like the next step of stepping into the waters of understanding betrayal trauma?
I really like this metaphor. It's called the hit by a truck analogy. And it's a pretty common one in betrayal trauma recovery. So picture, I'm going to use just kind of the stereotypical wife is the victim of betrayal trauma and husband is the one that's done the betraying. But that's not always the case, right? But so say the wife is just like walking down the street, just her typical normal day. And here comes husband, he's driving his truck down the road and she's like, oh, hi, there you are. And then he hits her and she's on the ground, like bleeding out, big, big wounds from this being hit by a truck. Now, our immediate reaction in this type of thing is run to the wife and see how she's doing. Mm-hmm. But in betrayal trauma, what ends up happening is, oh, husband was driving the truck. We better make sure that he knows how to drive.
Yeah.
Like, let's stop him from hitting people, which is also an important piece. But when we focus on husband, let's take care of your pornography addiction, or let's make sure we figure out what's going on with you. And we ignore the wife. She's just bleeding out on the side of the road. And so often we hear people come up and be like, well, if you'll just forgive him, then you're going to be fine. And we would never say that to someone lying on the side of the road. Just forget that person that hit you with their truck and you're going to be fine. Right, that's not what we would do, right?
Yeah, that's great.
So there's this importance of like, let's also give focus or sometimes shift focus, depending on what's happening with the husband, to the person who was wounded in this scenario. Mm-hmm. And husband's not going to be able to fix those wounds just by like being sober, no longer engaging in pornography. That's not going to heal the wounds. They need their own help and their own attention.
Yeah. He could jump out of the truck and say, don't worry, I'll never do it again. Wait, but this is the fifth time you've hit her with the truck. But no, this time I'm done.
I was just distracted for a second. Right. But right now, I'll no longer be distracted. It's not going to heal the wounds. It's not going to work.
And so from a church leader, we see this situation, again, not, you know, the metaphor is helpful, but like in a betrayal, you know, sexual betrayal or pornography or whatever it is, we see it like, well, if we can just fix the husband, he'll stop hitting you with the truck and then you'll be okay. Your wounds will heal. We can move on. Mm-hmm. So let's focus on him. But in reality, like you said, she's bleeding out.
Yeah. Because the pain that is happening is so internal and so private, she probably keeps it very internal because she's not quite sure who to even trust anymore. Mm-hmm. And so she's keeping it very internal. So it's almost logical to say, well, let's just fix the person who hit her with the truck. Like, let's make sure that never happens again and she will be fine. But we're missing this huge thing that's happening. I love that you called it a virus. This virus that's happening in the marriage, that's just, it's not going to be able to survive if the marriage is our focus. The marriage won't be able to survive unless she survives.
Right.
And she's not going to be able to survive if she's just left hanging.
Now, one thing I want to highlight here is that even the wife, even the spouse can think, yeah, let's just fix him.
Yeah.
Right. She doesn't realize the trauma that she's actually bleeding out. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, again, this, nobody's like, this is such a, you know, there's so much trauma happening. It just rocks our world that everybody involved can't really see straight at times, especially at the beginning.
For sure. And it's what's going on with the brain is it just wants us to be okay. Mm-hmm. And so the brain's going to find the easiest path to, this will never happen again. Let's make this be okay. So even her brain might go, oh, you know what? It's actually just him. Let's focus on him. All of my attention's, I love him and support him and have covenanted to be with him for forever. So we're going to get through this together and I will support him. Mm-hmm. And how often is she coming into the bishop's office to be like, let me hold his hand while he tells you what it is and how repentant he is. And she's right there like supporting him because her brain says, this will be the easiest way to fix the trauma.
Yeah.
But even she doesn't know it's this virus that she's got going on in her and these wounds that he healed.
Because the feeling, the natural feeling is like, don't you remember the days before your husband was hitting with trucks? We should go back to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
How can we get there the fastest?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Just forgive and forget.
And he's such a good guy. And we just want to get back to that. And then also we have this culture that's very much, you can't change your spouse. You can only change yourself. But if he needs to change himself, then I'm just going to support him and be here with him. And I'm not going to worry about me. I'm going to support him. And it just, we... for the sake of like being kind or Christ, like we put ourselves on the back burner and let me prioritize him and what he needs to do.
Yeah.
And kind of I'll ignore the things going on with me and support him. And it's kind of this backwards application of some of our cultural understanding of what we're supposed to do as a spouse.
Cool. Anything else is in terms of, you know, you references this bucket of behaviors. What is that? What do you mean by that? And how does that, how does that manifest?
It's fascinating how often I'll have women in my groups or women in my office, they'll come in and just say, you know, it really wasn't actually the cheating on me that hurt. It was the lying about it that hurt.
Right.
Because that's what really has undone any foundation we might have had. And along with that lying, there's usually some gaslighting where the wife usually knows she's got kind of a spidey sense that something is off. Mm-hmm. And she'll come and say, hey, is there something going on? And then he goes, no, we're fine. And that just subtle gaslighting to where now she's like, I don't know if I can believe myself, if I can trust myself when I feel like something is off, because he's saying everything's fine, even though I feel like something is off. So there's those subtle gaslighting that kind of chips away at her. And then there's the foundation of lies that chips away at the foundation of her understanding of the relationship. And then we also often will see like a defensiveness. Hey, were you just using pornography or were you meeting up with someone? And the initial reaction when someone's calling out maybe a dangerous behavior is to get defensive. And so the husband will respond with, no, I can't believe you would think that. I haven't done that. Mm-hmm. And so there's this defensiveness and there's some blame shifting. Well, if you would just be more intimate with me, then I wouldn't have to, type of thing. All of those behaviors that try to minimize the damage that's being done and shift the responsibility for it over onto the wife are all, they're just abusive behaviors. That's what they are. They remove the wife's ability to have agency because if she doesn't know the truth of what's going on or the truth about who you are, or the truth about what kind of behaviors you engage in, she no longer has the option to choose. how to respond to this relationship. So it's removing her agency. It's trying to keep her from having that full truth and having that full understanding. And it's treating her as an object, either one that's going to help me or one that's going to hurt me, right, or one that's, and it's putting her in this position of not being a person anymore. And that's the definition of abuse, is when there's that power dynamic that is unequal because one person holds all of the cards of the truth, mm-hmm, and is using that to control the other person. And so those abuse tactics are what really is causing the damage to the relationship and to the person.
Right. Even though we're getting the pornography behavior in line,
yeah,
you know, like, but all these other things are surrounding it under the surface, right?
Yeah.
Now, gaslighting, again, this become like a buzzword, yeah, at times, right? But essentially is when somebody is trying to convince somebody that they're crazy for believing what is true.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That, why would you second guess me? Well, because you blew up that bomb in our house. Like, you hit me with a truck. Like,
yeah.
And this is where, you know, the, not only then people think the spouse is crazy a little, mm-hmm, bit, like, I get that he messed up, but if you could just get your emotions.
Look how repentant he is, and you're kind of crazy right now.
Right. Yeah. But the spouse, the wife is always what I've learned is like the barometer. Mm-hmm. Even if there's no proof, there's energy there, there's feelings that she's picking up on.
Yeah.
Then when they come into the bishop's office, that's where the bishop could make the mistake of being like, okay, he seems repentant. You seem crazy.
Yeah.
What's going on here? Like, maybe the problem's you.
You just, right, need to forgive more.
And there we are falling in the trap, yeah, of the, what betrayal trauma can,
yeah,
cause. Right?
And it's so fascinating how that happens in a culture where we firmly believe in personal revelation and in making decisions based on that intuition, because, yeah, we have this gift of the Holy Ghost. And so it's interesting to see how quickly that's denied. Like, oh, you just think that something's up, but really you're being too sensitive or too critical. But her intuition is on. Mm-hmm. Like, it's always spot on. When something's off, it's because something is off. That's why she's feeling like something is off. And, yeah, so whether it's like he's dove deep down into his addiction and his behaviors has escalated because pornography addiction is an escalating addiction, or it's just he has shifted and started maybe treating her as an object a little bit, gotten into some of those bucket behaviors that happen side by side of the addiction, but aren't necessarily the same engaging in the addiction. She feels that. You feel it when someone isn't coming at you with sincerity or treating you as a person or, mm-hmm, seeing you as a person. You feel that because you're a person, and you feel that because your light of Christ goes, I don't know. And the Holy Ghost might say, something's off right here. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating how quickly we dismiss that in a culture that really holds that up.
Yeah. And I feel the tension, like for a church leader, or even loved ones that surround it, that there's this tension or this urgency of like, I have to believe one of them, right? Mm-hmm. Because even though she's feeling like something's off, she may be incorrect about some facts, right? And so correct me if I'm wrong, but like in these situations, for the leader to just sort of step back and just say, I'm just going to create space for all this. I don't have to decide he's right or she's right or he's lying or she's lying.
Yeah.
But we're just creating some space here because, again, the trauma is just reeling, yeah, right?
And everyone's just trying to figure it out. He likely is really afraid of what's going to happen if people see who he is. Mm-hmm. This is just common, that kind of shame spiral that happens with, mm-hmm, addiction. So he likely is really afraid, which means what he's presenting in his discussions to other people are probably not the whole truth, because, mm-hmm, he's really afraid of sharing the whole truth. So he's probably not where he's presenting he is. And she doesn't even know what the truth is right now, because for so long she said, I feel like something is off, but he's telling me we're fine. So can I trust it when I feel like something is off? And so her behaviors are going to be scattered. She's going to be talking kind of everywhere. And she might be super blaming. She might also be super critical. Well, you know, I was doing this and I'm not even sure. And so it's really hard to compare them and try to figure out who's right.
Yeah.
It's so much better if we just separate for a minute and say, let me work with you, the person, instead of you, the marriage. And let's find out what's going on with you so that I can validate you and hold space for you and give you the belief that what you say is happening, regardless of whether or not there's any other proof.
Yeah.
Let's just work from belief for right now.
Now, I want to share something very encouraging, that if there's a church leader listening to this, like the beauty of it is like, you don't have to figure out the situation. You don't have to, I mean, you're spiritual guide, you'll be encouraging. You know, one thing I love about our faith tradition is that bishops often are that threshold into professional therapy or help that they do need, right?
Yeah.
So the trap, though, is when you're like thinking, well, you need to forgive. We need to maintain this family. We sort of like everybody in this relationship is trying to maintain control. Like the, yeah, bishop feels like I need to grab the reins somehow and save this family, save this eternal marriage.
I can't let them get divorced on my watch. Like, I'm right here with them.
Yeah. And there's, you know, forgiveness and all these things we can go to. But then at the same time, the husband, maybe the addict, the husband is, he's maintaining control where this, I've had therapists describe to me as the spotlighting. Like, okay, he caught him with pornography, but she doesn't know there's actually a woman on the side, or there's a lot more history or something. But he's going to focus on that, because if he can say that, I'm sorry, I did this one thing, even though there's 10, he can maintain control of what's happening.
And I can be, he can be genuinely repentant for that one thing.
Right.
And so everyone will see that he's okay. He will feel like he's okay. I won't do those other things again. I'll make sure I'm very repentant for this one.
Now, then, correct me if I'm wrong, then the wife sometimes feels this like, I'm going to maintain control, but I'm going to get the best divorce attorney. We're going to do this tomorrow. And I've got papers filed already. And then everything's moving too fast,
Well, and it might even be control in a different kind of way, because likely throughout the relationship, there's been this little bit of, well, if you would be more patient, then I wouldn't be so stressed, so I wouldn't have to go act out. If you would be more understanding, then I wouldn't be so defensive. If you would be more intimate with me, then I wouldn't have this need, right? There's this underlying shift of blame that has gone to the wife. And her brain feels a whole lot safer if she is in control of what's happening. Mm. Because if she is in control of what's happening, then she can change. And then it will no longer happen. Mm-hmm. And so there's this safety that her brain built of, well, let me just control all of the things. Because if I can control all of the things, then I will stop getting hurt, because it's my fault.
Gotcha.
Because I'm going to believe that it's my fault, because it's so much safer to do that. And so even before it's, let's get the best divorce attorney, there has probably been decades of, let me tell you exactly what to do. Let me get you into recovery meetings. Let's make sure that we're doing this. And she's kind of trying to guide this force of coming togetherness in her own control way, because that's going to keep her safe if she can control the behaviors. If she can control what's going on, then she can stop the pain from happening to her.
And a lot of this is happening on a subconscious level, right?
Yeah.
As you may say,
yeah,
like,
this she's is not going to sit down and be like, this is what I need to do. Yeah.
But then through good therapy, that therapist can sort of help her step back and be like, look at what you're doing.
Yeah.
Like, because you feel unsafe and you're trying to grasp onto anything that's safe that you can control.
And good for you. Good job trying to keep you safe. Yeah. Let's find a way that's actually going to be helpful. I love what you said about the bishop isn't the person that's supposed to be healing all of that.
Right.
It's not their job. I think it's so important to remember that spouse is spouse and bishop is bishop and therapist is therapist. And all these people have different roles. They're not supposed to be the same people. They're very different roles. And so getting very clear as a church leader, what is my role in this? What does the handbook say I'm supposed to be doing when dealing with someone who's been abused? Mm-hmm. What's my priority with that person? What does the handbook say I'm supposed to be doing here? And then not taking on the roles that aren't yours, right? If they need professional help, which they do, going back to the hit by the truck analogy, if you were to come across this person bleeding out, laying on the ground, would you go, oh, it's my job to just gather her up and put her back in the truck and teach him, don't do this again? Mm-hmm. Or would you call 911, right? Like, what are you going to do here? What's your role? And so learning that it's not my job to save this family, because saving might not look like what you think it is. It's simply your job to get clear on the handbook. What do I do if someone's been abused? What do I do if someone's engaging in these things? And they're two individuals now just trying to heal from this trauma.
Yeah. Take us to just like, I don't know, like the first 4 to 6 weeks, like when that bomb goes off, that betrayal bomb goes off, like what are we looking for? Because my fear is that I feel like, you know, as a leader, when I was experiencing these situations in my ward, like everything was moving too fast. I just wanted to get it slow down, but I couldn't get it slow down. And then suddenly divorce papers are being filed or these tragic mistakes are being done because they're going to cause more problems. So like, what do we, and I'm not just talking from a leadership standpoint, but even for that couple, what should we keep in mind in those first where everything's so raw?
Yeah. Well, first, I think it is going to be pretty fast paced. Like if we're at a car accident and someone's bleeding out, EMTs are working quick, but it's not my job. So my first thing is get them to someone who can help them in a fast pace and to not assume that I know what's best. The church is so clear that in abusive situations, the church's job is to maintain the emotional, financial, physical stability and safety of the victim. Mm. So this wife coming into your office who's talking about betrayal trauma, she just needs to feel safety. Mm-hmm. And that might look like husband needs a couch to sleep on for a while. There might need to be some space, and that's not as scary as we think it is. There's an important step that happens in separation that allows for maybe the possibility of healing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that doesn't happen when we're together because we just keep bumping each other's wounds over and over and over. And so those wounds can't heal.
Yeah.
So there needs to be some breathing room. It might not be out of the home. It might not even be out of the bedroom, but just an understanding of I'm working with these two on an individual level. Mm-hmm. Both of them have completely separate needs. So I'm going to slow down from my frantic, let me save this marriage to let me get these people to the experts that can help them. And then let me work with them as individuals.
Yeah. And I appreciate the emphasis on safety. When someone feels betrayed and is experiencing trauma, like a great question, correct me if I'm wrong, great question a bishop could ask is, how can we help you feel safe, right?
Yeah.
We don't expect you to even live in the same house for a while.
Yes.
And so what can we do?
Yeah.
You have the means to get a small apartment or to have him get a small apartment? Or
he's getting the small apartment.
Do you have family nearby? Like,
yeah.
I think sometimes the temptation for church is just sort of like push the model, right? Being like, mm-hmm. well, just stay together in the same house, put that smile on for the kids and get through this. But if she doesn't feel safe, that's only going to inflame the trauma, the betrayal.
It's going to re-traumatize her over and over and over. And likely her trauma wounds are going to be bumping up against his shame wounds and they're just going to be hurting each other more. And so what can I do to help you feel safe? And some awareness that safety requires being separate from the person who hurt you for a while.
Yeah.
We're not going to expect someone who's just been hit by a car to get back in the car with the person that hit them. And so allowing that to not be scary.
That's really helpful for a church leader because, again, the temptation is you want to fix the problem.
Yeah.
And you feel a lot of pressure like, well, I got to keep this family together. But then you shift it from like, no, you just have to create safety. Now, there may be in your mind as they ask for a certain safety, you may think like, well, that's excessive. You know, it may be.
That's when you call up a therapist that you know. Right. Is this excessive? And what should I do? Because it's not your job.
Yeah, exactly. But the fact that you're just seeking for safety, that's your job. You can just ask that question. Make sure they get the resources.
Yeah. I want to support you and I want to make sure that you feel safe.
Yeah.
So what do you need?
Right.
We have resources. What kind of resources do we need to throw your direction right now?
And then it removes the burden of that leader feeling like, I have to believe one of these things. I need to find the truth. No, you don't have to find the truth because this is chaos.
Yeah. Right? What's going to be hard though is if her safety need is going to be additional moments where she doesn't feel like she's with him, he's going to feel very threatened by that because his shame is going to start speaking really loudly. And so he's going to feel like, well, separation is going to be the death of us and get really big. And so it's going to be hard to be able to differentiate the two. Mm-hmm. But recognizing the church's stance in the handbook says that the safety of the victim is the priority over the emotions or the feelings of the betrayer. And so allowing that to be prioritized, even when both their safety needs are looking different, and coming to him with something else.
Yeah. And I think it's encouraging for leaders to hear or anybody involved in situations. Like in the moment, it feels like the pressure to make a decision to do these things. But in hindsight, with a lot of these situations, you realize, oh, like this was a much longer journey. This wasn't like, let's figure out in 6 months who gets the kids or not. This is like a decade or 5 years where like we have plenty of time to work with. Sometimes in the moment, we just have to slow it down.
Yeah.
Right? And we'll get there.
And there's going to be a lot of energy, but my job is just, okay, hey, while we wait for the ambulance to come and do all of their special stuff, all of their big energy stuff, I'm just sitting with you on the side of the road going, it's going to be okay. Yeah. I'm right here. They're coming. I've called them, right? What can we do to help you feel okay right now?
All right. So there's the tough questions here that probably not a clear answer, but sometimes there's this pressure from maybe the wife of being like, oh, you want to know how I feel safe? What you can do is call a membership council, remove his membership and, you know, put him in, you know, spiritual timeout and forbid him from sacrament. Like you do these things. And sometimes it's like, whoa, wait a minute. Like there's this push of, again, action. I need you to punish him. That's what I need to do.
Yeah.
How do you respond to that?
Okay. The very beginning stages of trauma are going to look like a lot like this is what he's doing wrong. Mm-hmm. Because that's the only thing their brain knows right now is, his behaviors were wrong and they hurt me.
And it's got to stop.
And it's got to stop, right? So your job is to just go, okay, thanks for sharing. Mm-hmm. I hear you, right? You don't have to then take all of their recommendations, but you're not going to come back and say, well, actually you've been doing it. Just, I can, that sounds so painful.
Mm.
So let's make sure we get him the help that he needs, but that's not your job. I'll do that. And that help might look like a membership council or removing the sacrament. God, I and him will take care of that. Mm-hmm. So right now in this office, let's talk about what you need.
Yeah.
Right? Because he's not here because I'm meeting with you guys separately because you're individuals. So let's talk about your needs.
Yeah.
Right?
I appreciate those words of, I hear you. Like, I love a good phrase we can just fall back on. I don't know what to say. I hear you.
I hear you.
Hey, that worked. Wow, that's good.
And if you can repeat back what they said, I'm hearing you say that it was so frustrating that there have been no consequences for him.
Yeah.
Hey, trust me when I tell you God's got consequences, right? Mm-hmm. But let's focus on you right now.
Yeah. What's going on? And another phrase that I have used a lot is simply telling someone, you know, you're not crazy for feeling this way.
Yes.
Like anybody in your situation would feel like this.
Yes.
I would probably be worse. I don't know.
Yeah.
And just knowing that, because it feels like that when that gaslighting starts, it can feel like, I think I'm the crazy one.
Yeah.
Like there's something wrong with me, right?
I end all of my groups with, you're not crazy and you're not alone. Mm-hmm. Because it feels very isolating. One of the tactics that's used by individuals dealing with shame is to isolate. Don't tell my story. I'm going to work on it. I don't want people to think. One of the indicators of betrayal trauma is isolating. I'm the only one that's going through this. Nobody else has experienced that. And so there's lots of isolation that has happened. Mm-hmm. And so reminding them, you're not alone. I'm right here with you. And one of the resources that they're probably going to need is some priesthood leadership in their home, some blessings and some awareness that that particular part of the priesthood is no longer available to them right now. And so what kind of resources can I be, can I come into your home weekly and give you and your children a blessing? Can your ministering brethren come and do that? Would you like to come to my office weekly and get a blessing? Mm-hmm. Because they don't have access to that in their home right now. And boy, does it feel so vulnerable to try to ask for that outside the home, especially if my husband doesn't want anyone to know what's going on with him, for me to call up my ministering brother and say, hey, can I get a blessing? All of the questions are, well, why can't he do it, right? So it feels so scary. So their emotional well-being and their like spiritual power well-being all need some of those resources.
That's really helpful. So along that vein, there's this, you know, there's so much shame involved in these situations, and shame wants individuals to isolate and hide, right?
Yeah.
And so a lot of people, everybody involved is like, hey, let's go into the bishop's office, shut the door. Nobody's going to know what's happening here. Let's get this figured out. Let's get him back on track. Let's get you better. Let's get there, whatever. Don't let anybody know. But in reality, that only stimulates shame. Now, of course, it wouldn't be appropriate to just be like, hey, you know, ward council, the Johnsons, like, wow, he messed up. Let's get them, right? But nonetheless, I worry about the bishops who are like, take this all on their shoulders. Mm-hmm. And they're like, I will will this situation into a place of positive healing when, you know, he's trying to focus on the youth. And then he breaks down, right? Yeah. He needs his own therapy, right? So like, how would you suggest as far as involving community or making sure they have support or, I mean, what comes to mind?
There are just so many resources, right? Bishop's job can simply be to direct. We know for sure that Satan thrives in shadows and in secrets. So we know that that's happening if there's not going to be a safe place to share. That's what's going to be going on. We also know that it's not appropriate to break confidentiality. So I can't go to someone in the ward and say, hey, these people need your help. That's not going to be appropriate. I probably shouldn't even be going to my counselors if I'm president or a bishop that's been kind of disclosed to and brought into the circle of trust. Shouldn't be sharing that with other people without permission first. Mm-hmm. But I can say to the person, hey, you're not alone in this. And I've got some resources for you. Or if I don't, I can find some resources for you and get you someplace. There are all sorts of support groups, all sorts of recovery groups, all sorts of therapists that have connections to support groups and recovery groups so that isolation can be broken without breaking confidentiality.
Yeah. And it sounds like, I mean, it's all in the asking, one, do they have support in place? Mm-hmm. Whether it's professional support or family or a friend.
Yeah.
And then just asking how else can we support you? Because, I mean, in these situations, we think of the beautiful meals we take to the sweet mother who just had a baby, which great, you know, we should keep doing that. But like, nobody needs a meal more than, you know, maybe
more than this
family,
person,
right?
Yeah.
But then there's like, you know, hey, just so you know, there's something going on, right? That shame just gets a...
But even if you were to say, hey, with what's going on in your life, probably cooking food might be the hardest thing to be figuring out right now. Mm-hmm. Would you be okay if I looped the Relief Society president in and she could just find one or two people to bring you a meal once or twice a week? Mm-hmm. And just like, here's an idea, because let me know what I can do to help you is that phrase that no one's ever going to say, this is what you can do too, right? Yeah. So coming up with some ideas of, if my entire world has just disappeared, I don't know what my foundation is with my spouse. I'm not even sure I know who my spouse is because he's been lying this whole time. I don't know how to parent with this person because I don't know anything. And this person has hurt me so bad, but I prayed before marrying him. So can I even trust God? And now I've got this whole church situation going on and I don't know who I, they don't have the capacity to say, this is what I need. These are all of the detailed things that I need to do in order to feel okay. And so they might not be able to answer that question. Yeah. You can ask for sure.
Right.
But if they don't give you an answer, they're not able to give you an answer. Just putting yourself in their shoes and saying, I imagine if I were going through the kind of shattering that you have to be experiencing right now, I wouldn't be able to do laundry. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be able to find childcare. Mm-hmm. Can I help you find some of those resources?
Yeah.
And just kind of imagining, what would I be feeling if my whole world if I'd just been hit by a truck, but was still having to live life dealing with all of those wounds?
Yeah. Tell me about the children that may be involved, right? They have kids and bless their hearts. I mean, they talk about someone who's just victim in all ways. What to keep in mind for when there's children involved in this?
It's so hard.
Yeah.
What to keep in mind is that so often husband is counseled, really dig in spiritually. It's so important for you to take that time out so that you, and that's not wrong. But when he's busy focusing on how to stop hurting his loved ones, his wife is having to figure out how to do it all. Mm. She's having to figure out how to do all of just the home management and all of the child rearing. And if she's got a job, how to do that as well. And so those kids are probably in need of just some more, because we have one parent who's really got to focus on himself and one parent who needs to focus on herself, but isn't giving that opportunity.
Yeah.
So the kids know something's going on. Kids are not stupid. They intuitively yeah. pick up on things better than we do. So they know something's going on. So you might see them at church suddenly being louder or suddenly wandering around the church or having a hard time staying in class, or they feel something's going on and that's going to come out through actions and through sounds.
They're trying to cope.
Yeah.
Right?
They're just, and that
like
they're
the rest of us.
Crossing it through their body the way that kids do. So a whole lot of patience and a whole lot of opportunities to offer. Can we watch your kids for you so that you can go to this recovery meeting? It happens on Thursdays. Can we set up a babysitter so that you can go to that? Or, hey, I know primary's got to be really hard getting your kids ready for church. Can we come help get them there? Just the kids are going to be going through a lot. They don't know what's going on, but the mom is going through a lot of trying to figure out how to help her kids go through this thing.
Yeah. And I'll point out here that oftentimes you see, like, because the father is dealing with so much of the shame of it all. But what have I done? Who am I? I can't believe I did this. That he'll turn into a super dad, right? And again, this is part of the, like, what? Why are you getting after me? Look how good I am with the kids now. Like, I'm trying here, right? Yeah. And again, we're glad he's trying and being a good dad. But these are just indicators of, like, there's a lot of shame involved. It's just going to take some time to get that out of the system of the relationships.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And if your couple ends up, if the wife does need space, she is not expecting space and dad to not be a dad at all, right? She's expecting, please come and do all of these things. I just can't be sharing a home with you. So please show up and be part of the kids' lives. Please show up and take them to school and help them get ready and still be all of the father figure stuff. I just can't live in the same home with you right now. And so if you were working with the husband in that case, encouraging him to, hey, she still needs the partner in parenting. She can't share a home with you right now because that's got a whole bunch of other stuff with it. But that doesn't mean you're supposed to just check out and not be part of their life.
Yeah. Talk to me about this. You know, obviously, concept of boundaries, that's another, you know, buzzword, but an important buzzword. Sometimes a layperson doesn't quite understand that, even though we all have boundaries in our lives or we need more boundaries. And then that you sort of mix in the concept of forgiveness there, where the boundary can sort of feel like, well, you're not really forgiving him because you keep putting these boundaries up. And, you know, we can look at the scriptures and debate the theology of what forgiveness is and when we're commanded to do it and all these things. But oftentimes forgiveness can be a long journey. And that doesn't mean anybody's bad in this, but we're dealing with a lot of mortals here.
Yeah.
And they're just incapable of some of these. They need that healing and all these things to really get to a place of being like, I just completely forgive you. Right.
Yeah.
It sometimes breaks my heart when we sort of highlight some of these people that are, you know, they stand in front of the media after they're family's been murdered. They're like, I forgive the murder. And you're like, are you okay? Like, I mean, cause I don't know if I could do that, right? But anyways, but that forgiveness can come, right? Sometimes we feel like we force him, like we say the words, even though maybe it hasn't happened. So talk to me all about like boundaries and what a leader should consider about forgiveness and all of that. Where do you want to go?
Boundaries are my favorite topic. I love boundaries so much. I teach a class on boundaries. I talk about boundaries all the time. I think sometimes we think of boundaries as walls of I have to protect me. And so I am separating myself from you. And it's all of these walls. When in reality, all boundaries are is me figuring out who I am and who I am not. So I'm gonna start making my behaviors based on who I am instead of on these behaviors that maybe aren't in line with who I am. Mm-hmm. So that's a boundary of what kind of behaviors I'm gonna have, that what I'm okay with and what I'm not okay with. What am I in charge of and what I'm not in charge of? And the easiest example of boundaries is just fenced yards. We have yards in our front. We have fences around our front yard, and we are in charge of planting the gardens in there and mowing the lawns in there and taking care of all of that. And that's going to be my individual yard. My spouse is going to have their own yard that they are also in charge of, and it's going to take care of their all of their own behaviors. Now, if their behaviors are regularly encroaching on my yard, I'm going to need to get more space because I have to be in charge of my own yard. If I'm oftentimes my women in betrayal trauma come in and they really love to rescue. I call them rescuers. I say, welcome to Rescuers Anonymous. Like we just want to rescue all of the people, but that's not actually my job. My job is to live within my own yard. So I might find myself encroaching over into his yard. Oh, well.
Let me help you with your garden. Right?
Exactly. Let me plant your garden for you because you didn't get it in time. And so I know that that's going to lead to you not having it, which is going to sound something like, let me make sure that we drop you off at your recovery group because I know if you don't go to recovery group, then you're not going to be on there, right? So she might need space just to help her figure out what she is in charge of. And it's not an attack on him. And it's not meant to be like, danger, Will Robinson, we're separating. There's all of these walls. It's just, I need to figure out what I'm actually in control of, what I'm actually in charge of, and recenter into my own yard and what I'm doing. So I think of boundaries as defining who I am and what I'm actually in charge of. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is when we get clear on our boundaries and when we're vulnerable with, hey, this is who I am. This is deep down who I am and what I'm okay with. It opens us up in this really vulnerable way. And that's the only way that we're going to be able to have real connection with someone.
Yeah.
Because if I haven't given you clear understanding of who I am, then we're not bonding over who we really are. We're bonding over this fake version, this kind of shield that we've put up. And so boundaries are this really beautiful opportunity to have love in my relationship. And if I can come to my spouse and say, the gaslighting or the manipulation or the sexual acting out behaviors that you've been experiencing hurt me. And I cannot feel safe sharing a bed with you, sharing a home with you, sharing emotional information with you. Mm-hmm. I don't feel safe that way. I've got to get a little bit more space and a little bit more clarity on what I'm okay with. If my spouse responds with, I understand, or I hear you, or okay, I can honor that boundary, we've created this brand new foundation of, okay, I can express my real scary part of myself saying that I'm not okay with what you're doing and I'm not going to be attacked for it. And they're going to hold it and honor it and see me, the person, instead of the object. So it starts this new foundation that's going to be able to build into a healthy relationship where we see each other as people.
Yeah. And I think one thing that often gets missed, and obviously this is a leadership podcast, so we're talking about the leaders involved here, that the leader, the bishop, has his own boundaries, right? And and he should keep those boundaries. Yes. And that's going back to the question of the spouse is like, well, you need to take action against this guy and, you know, remove his membership and remove this. Like, hey, you're over in my garden here. Let's get back to your garden, right? I'll figure out my garden. We'll get there, right? And again, not that you'd say that, but that's the dynamic that's happening. Yeah. Like, oh, like, hey, yeah, I know you're trying to get control, but
equals safety for you.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Let's find safety. So, what type of fence? Where do you need to build? And how can I help you build that fence, right? And then once that's built, then, and again, this is where, when I say like slowing down the situation without these rash decisions, that's what boundaries help you do. It sort of just slows everybody down. Like you can be able to sleep somewhere tonight where you know you're okay.
Yeah.
And then that gives us another day to work with.
Yeah.
And then a week and then a month and we're making progress, right?
Yeah. So. And that slowing down, it's funny. We're going to slow it down and give time for all of that. But that doesn't then have a time frame on it because we've slowed it down. So it might take 3 months. It might take 3 years. We don't actually know how much damage was being done behind the scenes and what kind of work that's going to take. So when we slow it down, it also has this understanding of we're slowing it down and we don't know how long the process is going to take. It's going to be probably longer than we had hoped. Mm-hmm. Even if we if we haven't expressed exactly what our time frame is, it's going to take longer than we hope. It's going to take longer than we hope. As the wife recovering, it's going to take longer with the spouse, the pornography addiction recovering. It's going to take longer as the bishop going, okay, now I'm helping these two individuals, but they still aren't coming together. So are we really helping or are we not? It shouldn't take longer.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I don't know why it's so prompt to go this way. As far as with disclosure, And I did a great interview with Jeff Struer about the, like, how to use therapists for appropriate disclosure. Mm-hmm. Because some, when the betrayal happens, it may be, you know, it rocks their world, everybody's world, the spouse's world. And the betrayer is thinking, oh boy, this isn't even half of it. Yeah. Right. And so, and sometimes there's this feeling, well, you tell me everything. I want to know it all. Mm-hmm. Like, how long is, you know, when in reality, that's just going to traumatize her further and makes a mess of things more. Where, anyways, what, talk to me about appropriate disclosure and things to keep in mind there.
As a leader in the church, it's just not your job, right? Yeah. Keep your boundaries. Mm-hmm. So she's going to need to have disclosure, because if you've been, like, if you have a tiny little sliver in your hand, it's going to hurt until you find the thing that was the sliver. Mm-hmm. You won't be able to say, oh no, I'm fine. It was a long time ago. I don't need to know that. It's going to hurt. And so these little seeds of mistrust or of abuse or of betrayal, they've been planted. They've happened in the marriage and they're going to need to be seen. We're going to have to get them out. But my job as bishop, I don't need to facilitate that. My job as Relief Society president, it's not my job to facilitate that. I can say, hey, it's going to be important that we know what the wounds are. We, the couple, not we, the bishop necessarily. Uh-huh. So let's make sure we get you some help.
Yeah.
Here are some people. And here's how I can support you being able to go see some people.
Yeah. That's awesome. All right. Where else do we need to go that we haven't touched on yet?
One thing that's just, that's, I've thought about a couple of times is, it's so, because we're such an eternal family focused culture, which is beautiful and wonderful and important doctrine, it's so easy to go right into what you're talking about of, let me save this family. Let me make sure that, and the assumption that I know what will save their family and the assumption that I know what their family is supposed to look like in the end, we just don't have that information. We don't know. We're not God. So, but what we do know is that the worth of souls is great in the sight of God, that these two individuals are great in the sight of God. And so we might need to pause the eternal family shoving for a second to attend to the thing that is of worth to God.
Yeah. And that's the thing, like, even if we did know what the person needed, like, it's just, there's so much going on. Like, it's almost, we're just setting that aside. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
It might be in a year or 2 years, but, and I empathize with all leaders who feel that pressure of, like, no, these are sacred covenants.
Yeah.
You know, and,
That's a thing.
It can feel overwhelming.
Yeah.
But again, we'll get to that, right? And that's the other things of, you know, sometimes the spouse is like, oh no, we're divorcing tomorrow. Like, yeah, that, this is what, we'll get to that. Yeah. Maybe you do need a divorce.
And
we'll,
sometimes the spouse is, we're in marriage counseling tomorrow. Uh-huh. We'll get to that.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, we have two individuals who are hurting from completely different perspectives. And we focus a lot on, let's get you through your addiction and sobriety and over here and over here. We focus so much on helping him to maybe find some stability focused on his addiction. Hopefully we also attend to those other buckets of behaviors and remove some of the abuse that's going on. We forget that her side includes a lot of healing and a lot of work. And she needs just as much individual attention and just as much individual face time to just heal, to work through things and to figure out what she feels is forgiveness. I'm not going to tell her what forgiveness is, but how does that look for her? And what does trust look like for her? And how are we going to build that and give her all of that individual attention?
Yeah.
Because even marriage counseling tomorrow isn't going to be helpful.
Yeah.
Until two individuals have healed, the marriage can't.
Perfect. And healing does happen.
Yeah.
I mean, these are the most inspiring stories that I've heard in mortality of these beautiful marriages that come from this. Who, absolutely, there were, went through a point where even I was like, oh, this ain't working out. Like, there's no way. And just beautiful marriages, right? Yeah. And even to the point where they get back to sort of the net zero, like they get back to what they were before, but then they've discovered, oh, we had so much more to work on.
Yeah.
And they, now they're in a place where they can go there.
Yeah. And I would say that they don't get back to what they were before. They get back to what is truth.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Because if there was that level of connection that they thought they had, but there was actually this underlying betrayal that was happening, that wasn't truth. And so they can heal and grow into this level of truth where they have a real relationship now based on vulnerabilities and understanding of who the other person is.
But that's the temptation, right? We all want to just get back to where you were.
Yeah.
Isn't that awesome?
Don't go back there.
But in reality, when in hindsight, all these couples are like, oh, I'd do it over again. Like, no, you know, I don't want to generalize, but just that journey they went on was so beautiful. And Christ enters in and heals and healing happens.
And healing does happen even when it's a beautiful divorce. The end game, the goal, the prize isn't having a healed relationship. It's having a healed person and having a person who feels connected with Christ and having a person who understands his role in their life. And having a person who's gone through this stage of, my whole life has fallen apart and now I'm rebuilding my understanding and my faith, my trust and my reliance on the atonement, that individual salvation, that worth of that soul is just as beautiful as the marriage. even if the marriage ends in divorce, the healed individuals are still beautiful and still miraculous.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the other thing, you know, we talk about eternal marriage and this pressure to like, keep it together, which of course, I mean, we would all love to have our eternal marriage work on the first go.
Yeah.
But there's processes, administrative processes to, you know, cancel ceilings. And you, again, talk to these people on the second, third marriages. And again, not that we, that's the, I don't know, not the ideal, whatever.
Nobody grows a child going, I hope one day I get divorced.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not right. The end goal initially.
But nothing's lost.
Yeah.
Like their exaltation is there. The ordinances, the covenants are there. Like that's the beauty of having our Savior is that he still makes that available no matter how many times. And I've talked to people on third, fourth marriages and they still get it.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. That's redemption. Yeah.
You know? And whether they individually heal and then are able to heal as a couple, or whether they individually heal and then go, it turns out our relationship isn't actually compatible. We have two different wants, two different ways that we want to live. Or one individual heals and the other is still struggling. And so the relationship still can't work. Whatever that might be, the covenant and the power and the realness of God's hand in their life is still this miraculous thing to witness.
Yeah.
Either way.
All right. Tell me about this awkward relationship at times of the bishop talking with, you know, the bishop becomes a resource. He finds some professional help. He hopes they get it. And there's some communication there. Maybe the bishop's helping pay for it, whatever. And so the bishop wants to help. And so he talks to the therapist. And I mean, anything you would recommend, like, cause how do I know as a bishop that I'm actually getting him good help? You know, you're someone that has, you know, an expertise in betrayal trauma. So you get all these things. Maybe another therapist isn't as helpful or anything you'd say to make sure that we know we're getting good help.
Yes. It's hard to find and crucial to find someone who understands betrayal trauma specifically. For a long time, there was this push of finding someone who has like a sex addiction training. Mm-hmm. And that's not wrong, maybe for that individual. We need to find someone who has betrayal trauma specific training and understanding of what's going on there. Because someone who doesn't, there's a whole lot of really good, healthy relationship information that can really, really, really harm someone in betrayal trauma. Mm. And therapist trauma is a thing. That's something that happens where you go to a therapist and you think that they're going to be helpful and it turns out that they're really harmful.
Yeah.
And so as a leader trying to find someone help, my favorite resource is psychologytoday.com. And you can narrow it down.
Like filter the results.
Filter. That's what I was looking for. Yeah. You can filter the results to betrayal trauma specific, right? And location specific. And even member of the church specific so that they can understand kind of the cultural nuances that come with experiencing this type of thing.
And this is the hard part because therapy can, that the expense can add up so quick, but you want to get good help. But also there's this feeling of like, I need therapy. So I go find one therapist to give me therapy. But sometimes it might be a team of people, right?
Yeah.
That, and I would imagine maybe, I'm just thinking maybe the leader in Podunk, Minnesota, who doesn't have just all these resources of therapists, even Latter-day Saint therapists, maybe they find a good therapist, a general therapist, but then they could maybe connect with someone like you or another person that's maybe just making sure we're online with the betrayal side. Is that?
Yeah, absolutely. Teams are so important. And I say therapists are like t-shirts. Not all of them are going to fit on you, right? Uh-huh. You got to try on a couple. And so trying a few different ones, allowing it, like if the church was being used as a resource to help pay, allowing that person to try two or three, find someone that fits with what you're needing and what you're looking for and see if that person works for you. And then I love groups so much. There's so many important things that happen in group work. It was interesting in grad school, I was studying group work and they were talking about all of the benefits of having people that can come together and be able to share their experiences and buoy each other up. And the next day I went to a fast and testimony meeting and I looked around and went, the Lord is so smart. He knows that we need these kind of group experiences where we buoy each other up. Those types of things that are beneficial from fast and testimony meeting, where we're hearing each other's testimonies and seeing each other's growth, comes in group forms for betrayal trauma, where we can see people farther down the road. We can see people who have just maybe had that day that exploded on them and go, oh, okay, I'm not alone. And there's a big path and there's some patterns that we're following and I can get some help here.
Yeah. And so group work is when you, it's like a therapist session, but with multiple people who've been through something similar or who are dealing with, and then hearing each other's stories and working with each other under the supervision of a therapist, it creates a different dynamic that's really helpful rather than let's just get in the secret office, shut the door.
Absolutely.
And we're going to work this out. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. That's awesome. All right. Anything, I mean, this is a concept that deserves its own 10 episode series, but Anything else, other point, principle, or concept we need to make sure we cover?
I love the resource. It's a book written by Ryan Anderson called The Choice to Leave Abuse. And it has that word leave in it. So we kind of get a little bit scared because what about eternal families? But what I like about it is I think of it as the choice to leave abusive behaviors. So if I'm the person who is engaged in abusive behaviors, this is me learning what those look like and choosing to no longer engage in them. Mm-hmm. If I'm the victim, this is me going, oh, that was abuse. And I actually don't have to say that it's okay. I don't have to take on the responsibility that this is my fault. I'm going to leave that abusive behavior behind. And it's got a whole section in there for church leaders. It's written by a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Oh, really?
And so it's all supported by doctrine. It's supported by scripture. It's supported by the church handbook and very clear help there. I love that resource. I think everyone needs to read this book. It's incredible. And then there's this kind of underlying idea I've ran into. I've spoken with a couple of bishops or Relief Society presidents about it of, well, that's not happening in my ward. Like, I can see why this would be helpful, but my ward's the exception. And just the recognition that this is prevalent.
Yeah.
10 out of 10 men have been exposed to pornography by the time they graduate high school. That statistic is about 2 years old. That exposure doesn't necessarily equal addiction. Use doesn't equal addiction, but it is an escalating thing. So if 10 out of 10 have been exposed, we have quite a few who have escalated into addiction. And 8 out of 10 women have been exposed by the time they get out of high school. If 8 out of 10 have been exposed, there's this escalation that's going to happen. And then the self-report statistics suggest that 3 out of 10 men have experienced abuse in their relationship and 7 out of 10 women. Mm. And so this is prevalent. It's happening in your ward while you're sitting on the stand on Sunday. Count your marriages. 3 out of 4 women are going to say that their spouse is engaged in pornography use. 3 out of 4. That's quite a few. Just count 1, 2, 3. You're the only one that's safe. 1, 2, 3. You're the only one that's safe, right? There's a lot of this. And so it might not be spoken about prevalent. Your ward's not the exception.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that need this kind of understanding and help.
Yeah. What would you say? Because I've talked to those leaders who are like, this doesn't seem to be a problem, but I know it is. Like, and they don't know what to do. Like, any advice on that? Like, how to de-shame these dynamics enough so that they begin to ask for help?
Have the conversation, right? Just have the conversation. Just make it so that it's not taboo to talk about. And I'm not saying we're going to sit down in our Sunday meetings and say, everyone tell us your greatest sins. Like, we don't, that's not what we need to have.
7 out of 10 of you.
Right,
I know.
Right. I know. So, but just in a fifth Sunday meeting or in a ward activity or something, or even with the youth, talking about what is abusive dynamics? What do they look like? And making that a conversation, because especially if we've grown up in a scenario where we've largely seen either healthy relationships or super abusive relationships, either one lead us to not understand what healthy relationships are. Mm-hmm. Because if it's you've only ever seen healthy dynamics, then you assume that what you're experiencing is just like the backside of those healthy dynamics. Mm-hmm. Like, I just need to, and if you've only ever seen abusive dynamics, you think that this is normal. And so just having conversations about what is healthy relationships and what are things to watch for if maybe you have, if you have some of these dynamics happening in your home, and what kind of resources out there, what kind of help is out there. We had a really cool fifth Sunday lesson where members of the Internet Crimes Against Children came and gave us this whole presentation about, here's how to keep our kids safe. What if we do things like that for, here's what to look for. Here's how to make sure your marriage is a healthy one. Here's what it looks like if it's not healthy. And here's where some resources are to get you some help.
Love it. And one of my go-tos is the simplest form is just inviting some of these couples who've gone through this, who found healing, to come and share their story. Yes. And just like sharing their story, they're like, oh, you mean you didn't die at the end of this? Like, if I speak up, I won't just, you know, fall over dead. And so it de-shames it enough and gives them a point like, well, I have a hard time talking to my bishop, but maybe I could talk with that guy, you know, and then the road begins.
Absolutely. I think there's likely people in your ward who are willing to speak. And so asking them or finding someone in your stake, or even if they're not willing to speak, they're willing to be a resource. So then when you have someone in your office, you can say, this person's given me permission to give out their phone number. Maybe reach out, right? And encourage them to find some connection.
Cool. All right. Good introductory to betrayal trauma. There's a lot to consider. And this would be one that I think leaders could listen to a few times and just pick up different nuggets.
Absolutely.
And especially when you're in the moment, right? You just got that phone call. What do I do?
Listen to
this and hopefully it'll give you a place to start moving.
Absolutely.
So, any other principle? We're good?
I think that's all the stuff that was on my mind.
If people do want to reach out to you about your resources, and you're a licensed therapist in Utah, but you do some coaching
out of Utah.
And so where would they find you?
You can find me at rejoicerecovery.org.
Nice.
Yes.
Last question I have, your room full of church leaders who are dealing with these types of things, what final encouragement would you give to them?
Oh my gosh, you don't understand. And that is okay. Don't pretend like you do. It is okay if you have this woman in your office breaking down or looking like she's crazy or she's super angry. All of these emotions are important and necessary, and you don't need to fix them. And it's okay to just say, oh, I don't understand this, but I'm going to go get some resources and I'm going to go get us some help and we'll figure it out together.
Hey, you made it to the end of the episode. Wasn't that so good? You know, I tend to pinch myself that this is what I get to do. I get to sit down with some remarkable people across the world, experts, everyday leaders, PhDs, therapists, whatever it be, and have such an impactful conversation. I hope you'll share it. Drop it into text message, an email, and share it to someone who maybe came to mind during this episode. And if you go to the show notes and scroll to the bottom, there's actually a list of some of our most popular episodes. So don't stop with this episode. I mean, you're not done with the dishes or mowing the lawn or working out, so you might as well keep it going at the bottom of those show notes and make sure you listen to each one, maybe a couple times on a few of them. And remember, grab your copy of my new book, Is God Disappointed in Me, on Amazon or in select Costco stores.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the own and only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness. The loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.